From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A week ago, New York City went to the polls and came away with a new kind of mayor. Bill de Blasio, the unabashedly liberal, progressive public advocate who campaigned on ending New York's Tale of Two Cities inequality, won in a landslide and vowed on election night to take a new way.
Make no mistake, the people of this city have chosen a progressive path.
Now the whole country's watching to see whether and how Bill de Blasio takes on historic inequality in New York, to see if there may be lessons here for good or ill for the whole nation. This hour, On Point, Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio's progressive vision for New York and the realities that await him. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you expect in the transition from billionaire Mayor Michael Bloomberg to progressive Bill de Blasio? Will he, can he end the Tale of Two Cities in the home of Wall Street? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Big welcome today to our newest listeners on the Radio IQ Network, serving the Commonwealth of Virginia. Great to have you right there. Joining us now from New York is Chris Smith, contributing editor at New York Magazine. He's talked plenty with Mayor-elect de Blasio and the outgoing mayor, Michael Bloomberg. His latest column on Bill de Blasio, the new mayor's frenemies, is on our website, onpointradio.org. Chris Smith, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is it everybody thinks it's a whole new day in New York?
Sure. Certainly tonally and stylistically, we'll see how much in the substance of policy de Blasio won with a very specific agenda in a lot of ways. You're right. He talked consistently and thoroughly about being a corrective to the 12 years of Michael Bloomberg as mayor, where, as he put it, and in many ways true, big business, the financial industry, the real estate industry took precedence in a lot of city policies. Bloomberg, in my view, doesn't get enough credit for some progressive initiatives in a lot of areas. But it's indisputable that the wealth gap is an increasing chasm and problem in the city. And de Blasio, early and more deeply than his opponents in the Democratic primary, identified that as a source of pain and complaint in the electorate in New York, in everything from the public school system to how the police department treats minority communities in particular through the use of stop and frisk tactics. And de Blasio says he's going to change that all drastically.
You write that Bill de Blasio ran the most surgically focused mayoral campaign in modern New York political history, relentlessly repeating a few key phrases, a tale of two cities and income inequality among them. I want to look at the policies that he's likely to actually put up, what he's likely to achieve. A couple pieces here, Chris, from his victory speech last Tuesday night. This was at the Park Slope Armory in Brooklyn. Talking about a tale of two cities, the widening gap between rich and poor in New York, he called that inequality the defining challenge of our time. Here he is.
Inequality in New York is not something that only threatens those who are struggling. The stakes are so high for every New Yorker. And making sure no son or daughter of New York falls behind defines the very promise of our city.
Between Michael Bloomberg and Rudy Giuliani before him, it has been a long time since we heard this kind of progressive talk with the label right up front. Here was Bill de Blasio again, victory speech just a week ago.
New Yorkers are strong and resilient, dedicated and big-hearted. Our greatness is not accidental, but neither is it inevitable. To maintain that greatness and to ensure that our brightest days are ahead of us, we must commit ourselves to progressive ideas that will lift us all up.
Talking progressive very prominently there on his victory night, Bill de Blasio, what exactly has he promised, Chris Smith, in New York?
Well, three things very specifically and with the highest profile during the campaign. The first, a tax increase on New York residents making $500,000 or more a year. De Blasio wants to raise their taxes from their marginal tax rate from 3.86% to 4.41%.
And we should remind people New York has an income tax, unlike many municipalities around the country.
Yeah, we find ways to have taxes that lots of other people don't. He will use that money, de Blasio says, to pay for universal pre-kindergarten for New York City's kids and for an expansion of after-school programs, primarily in the middle school years. One hurdle in making that happen is that that type of tax increase is not controlled by New York City government. It has to be approved by the state legislature. So he's got to go to Albany and persuade them to raise taxes on the wealthy in 2014, which will be an election year for state legislators and for the incumbent governor, Andrew Cuomo. Second thing de Blasio has talked about as a weapon to reduce income inequality is increasing the stock of affordable housing in the city. I believe the number he uses is 200,000 units over the next 10 years by requiring developers to use mandating inclusionary zoning, that if a developer puts up an apartment building, some percentage has to be set aside for lower or middle income levels. The third thing that he's talked about repeatedly and emphatically is mending, in his view, community police relations. You know, we've had hundreds of thousands of residents of color stopped who had done nothing wrong. The crime rate has gone down dramatically here, and Ray Kelly and Mike Bloomberg believe that aggressive stopping and frisking has been a major part of it. De Blasio says he can reduce the number of innocent people harassed and keep crime down just as low or lower.
So he's got three big promises there and more kind of implied. I want to look at all that. Such an interesting guy. I mean, big supporter of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua all the way back in the 80s. Worked for Andrew Cuomo with HUD, of course, in New York. Was campaign manager for Hillary Clinton when she ran for Senate. African-American wife for a long time now, and kids from that marriage who were very prominent in his campaign, very effective, I think, in that campaign. Michael Bloomberg, you've talked with him. He says this guy risks killing the golden goose if he goes down this road. Does he really, Chris?
I don't know. I mean, Bloomberg's point is essentially mathematical, that the city has a great many generous and expensive social programs, and in Bloomberg's view, most of those are paid for by attracting high-end industry, high-wealth individuals, and that de Blasio, by being anti-business or somewhat hostile to that income level, is going to scare those people off. They're going to move elsewhere because he's raising their taxes, because he's not giving them the encouragement to move here from around the world. Yes, we certainly need more people paying more taxes here to support city government. But there's a lot of research that shows that this kind of, you know, minor tax increase isn't going to drive people to Miami or London or wherever it may be.
Bill de Blasio may test the hypothesis right here. Chris Smith, standby in New York. Mitra Kalita joins us right now as well from New York. Ideas editor at Quartz. It's the Atlantic Monthly's online business publication. Former Greater New York section editor at the Wall Street Journal. Mitra Kalita, thanks very much for being with us. Tale of Two Cities. Was that a justified label that Bill de Blasio hung around the Big Apple, New York?
So the economic research very much says it was a justified label. New York, of course, is among the richest cities in the country and to some extent the world. But it also holds the distinction of, on another economic indicator, having the worst inequality in the United States. And it's actually Boston. Boston is second to New York City, followed by Dallas and Houston. And so what we saw over the last decade or so was truly great expansion at the top of the income pyramid. The richest neighborhoods in New York City, their median income grew by 55%, whereas the poorest neighborhoods in New York City saw their income stay flat or in some cases actually decline. So Bill de Blasio very much used statistics. He just spoke about them much more eloquently and appealed to voters that were not a part of this expansion and boom years that it looked like New York City was experiencing. And any visitor to New York over the last 10 years, of course, saw our streets cleaner, crime was down, Times Square looked completely different.
Looks pretty great.
That's right. But, where did all of that, where did all of those businesses go? Where did those people go? He really did appeal to the voters in, in many cases in the outer boroughs. He himself is from Brooklyn. And just tapped into, I think, a great sense of discontent over the status quo.
We want to look at where that is likely to go. Mitra Kalita, please stand by in New York. And Chris Smith with New York Magazine on his election night, victory night, saying, "We're not royals. We're ordinary folks down here. We need relief. Tale of Two Cities is the Dickens reference, rich and poor." This was the song he played on victory night. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We didn't come for money, but every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care. We're driving Cadillacs in our dreams, but everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal.
Royal.
Crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New York City's new mayor-elect, Bill de Blasio, now the country's most prominent progressive politician with a landslide win and a mandate to fight inequality in the city of Wall Street and big money finance. Chris Smith is with us, contributing editor at New York Magazine. Mitra Kalita is with us from New York, ideas editor at Quartz, former Greater New York section editor at the Wall Street Journal. He ended up mopping the floor with the Republican mayoral opponent here, Joe Loda. But Joe Loda's attack ad warned about de Blasio's record on crime, what kind of city New York would become under de Blasio, fighting progressive.
New York City is one bad mayor away from a return to unsafe streets and increased crime. Bill de Blasio voted to cut 5,000 cops. Unlike Bill de Blasio, Joe Loda supports the NYPD and will add 5,000 cops. On Election Day, ask yourself, do you want to be safe or sorry?
Of course, Bill de Blasio beat him by almost 50 points. And on election night, he said it wasn't about taking anybody down, threatening anyone's success, about giving everyone opportunities, said Bill de Blasio.
So when we call on the wealthiest among us to pay just a little more in taxes to fund universal pre-K and after-school programs, we aren't threatening anyone's success. We are asking those who've done very well to ensure that every child has the same opportunity to do just as well as they have. That's how we all rise together.
Bill de Blasio on election night. Mitra Kalita, you were at the Wall Street Journal. What about that claim right there? We aren't threatening anyone's success. Is Wall Street buying that, Mitra?
So I think there is concern over how efficient de Blasio is going to run New York City government. And then just from my, Michael Bloomberg was a known entity to these guys. They were friends with him. They socialized together. And it was a completely different dynamic. But when you listen to de Blasio, what's interesting is that he doesn't actually use the term Wall Street. He talks about wealthy New Yorkers. He is quite specific. So anyone who's familiar with the Occupy Wall Street movement, one frustration of that movement was what do they really want? And from the clip that you just played, de Blasio is very concrete in what he wants: universal pre-K, more affordable housing. And he kind of has this list of, you give us a little and we gain a lot. And I think that's going to be really interesting to watch over the next 4 years, is that I think it was Chris that used the term tonally. Mm-hmm. Tonally, you know, this guy is not some, you know, he's a real left-wing liberal, but he's not someone who's just going to rage for the sake of raging. I think he knows that he needs to play a certain tactic, has to work with big business. And, you know, the interesting economic dynamics of New York City is that, you know, anyone who's studied the wealth distribution, mm-hmm. and New York knows that Wall Street plays a very key role here. And the number of jobs in Wall Street actually has not expanded all that much over the last 30 years. What you've actually seen is just their salaries have just ballooned tremendously, and so much of the city is actually dependent on those high incomes. And de Blasio knows this better than anybody, which is why he wants to tax them.
Some people say he's a deal guy. We'll see how that might work out. Ellis Hennigan joins us in just a minute here. Chris Smith, I want to get you on expectations, if we may. I mean, from each side here, you write that de Blasio, quoting you here, played brilliantly in his campaign, primary in particular, to the hopes, angers, and guilts of the city's liberal, Bloomberg-fatigued Democratic primary electorate, where a lot of this, of course, played out. So what about expectations now? Expectations at the top of the Tale of Two Cities, at the top rung? And what about expectations among poorer New Yorkers? Is pre-K and after-school programs going to be enough to satisfy this sense that we're going to take on inequality? That's a big issue, Chris.
It is, and that's a fascinating question. You know, de Blasio ran a very smart campaign, and I remember near the end of it being with him, watching him on a Sunday morning at an African-American church in Crown Heights, speaking to a lot of people who are struggling economically, who have, you know, sons and fathers who they, you know, encounter hostile cops every day. And here was de Blasio telling them essentially that a lot of that's going to change, and a lot of that's going to change quickly. Now, it's much harder to do that on a day-to-day basis than it is to talk about it in a campaign. And as I've talked to de Blasio's camp, inner circle, whatever you want to call it, in the past few weeks,
yeah,
they've been stressing how once he's in office, he's going to continue, you know, to campaign essentially, that he's going to get out into neighborhoods that Bloomberg didn't visit often and talk with people, and that will help change the mood. But he's also going to look to do things, and they point to Harold Washington, when he was first elected mayor of Chicago, doing things like changing the sanitation pickup schedule in poor neighborhoods to show that city government really was distributing services much more fairly and equitably. De Blasio is going to look to do those kinds of things, which sound, you know, procedural, but both have an impact on people's day-to-day lives and show that city hall cares more about them. Actually moving the needle on income inequality, you know, de Blasio is realistic. He knows that's a very difficult lift for a mayor all by himself. You know, he's going to continue to pursue the policies that he talked about in the campaign, things like paid sick leave, things like expanding the living wage legislation, so that people, you know, slowly can make – gain a little ground economically. But he knows it's going to be tough in a year, 2 years, 3 years to point to, you know, a drastic change in that income inequality gap.
Big talk, big expectations. The whole country watching in a way, because this is, of course, an issue that plays out all over the United States. We're not throwing stones here today. Mitra, as you say, Boston, where I'm sitting, right up there behind New York in terms of inequality. But really interesting to see how New York goes after so many years, first of Rudy Giuliani and then of Mayor Michael Bloomberg, billionaire. Chris Smith, please stand by in New York. And Mitra Kalita, it's great to have you both with us. I want to turn right now to Ellis Hennigan, columnist with New York Newsday, AM New York, Fox political analyst. Ellis Hennigan, welcome back to One Point. Thanks very much for being here. What do you make of the promises that have been made here and what New York now expects, Ellis?
Well, they were grand. They have us all excited, and we sure hope he can achieve a lot of those things. But it's going to be tough. I mean, let's talk about income inequality for a second.
Yeah.
Right. What caused that wasn't the lack of pre-K. Okay. I mean, we'd all like children to be going to school at very young ages. But, you know, we used to have a lot of manufacturing jobs in New York, which were a great road into the middle class. And most of those jobs are gone. And they've been replaced by service sector jobs, which we're happy to have, but don't provide the same kind of upward mobility that those old jobs did. And, boy, if you can think of some way that the new mayor can snap his fingers and bring manufacturing back to New York, I and about 9 million other New Yorkers would sure like to hear it.
But a lot of people know, including people at the top. The Times has, quoting Catherine Wild here, the big business group, saying Bill captured the disconnect for many New Yorkers between the fact of the city's prosperity and the reality of their lives in this increasingly unaffordable city. A lot of people just can't afford to live there or falling into that gap or falling right out of the game, Ellis.
He did a brilliant job of capturing that. And you're absolutely right. Even the rich people feel that here, because even if you make a lot of money here, you probably have the same $3 in your checking account. You know, where does it go?
It takes a lot to live, yeah.
I don't think any of us. I mean, if you told me what I make, I'd feel rich until I wondered where it all went. But you know, life in New York right now, right? It's very good in a lot of ways. I mean, it's almost impossible to get mugged here, even if you try. There's a wonderful cultural stuff, high and low. They're interesting people. It's a great multicultural mix, and most days we mostly get along. But gosh, real estate is so expensive. You know, how does anybody move here now? Right? It's so expensive to rent or to buy, and it's really from that, I think, that so many of these other frustrations echo. And, you know, how do you make housing cheaper, right? I guess the best route is to build more housing, which means figuring out some kind of accommodation with real estate developers who maybe we have to decide aren't the villains but maybe our saviors in some way. And Chris was mentioning those formulas where we can say, yes, you can build the big fancy condo with the $3 million one-bedroom apartments, so long as you put some apartments in there that that folks making a whole lot less money can move into. But that's a good thing to do. We should do more of it. But I don't think they're going to be built by the day after tomorrow.
Life is good in New York, Ellis Hennekin says, but not good enough for way too many, said the candidate who is now mayor-elect of New York. Ellis Hennekin, Chris Smith, Mitra Kalita, all joining us from New York today. We're looking at progressive politician, now mayor-elect of New York City, to come in behind billionaire Michael Bloomberg, Bill de Blasio, and we've got listeners and callers all over the country interested in this. Let's turn to them. Dan in Omaha, Nebraska. Dan, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I'm actually a founding member of Occupy Omaha, and one of the biggest criticisms I heard back when Occupy was going on was that, unlike the Tea Party, we had not gotten any candidates elected. And my answer to that is that, you know, what happened with the Tea Party is that the candidates who are elected stand for no Tea Party ideals at all. And now we have Bill de Blasio in power. So it's taken a very long time for that to happen, you know, 2 years to reach maturity. But here we are seeing someone who's actually been arrested as part of the movement. And I'm so excited to see what he does.
Do you think it means something to you in Omaha, Nebraska, that Bill de Blasio will be mayor in New York City, Dan?
Absolutely, because any changes that happen in New York have the in New York City have a chance of happening in New York State, which has a chance of happening everywhere in the country. Like what we're seeing with the marijuana issue right now is that slowly but surely we're on the downward slope where it's just going to start snowballing and people are going to be turning over very rapidly.
Dan, I appreciate your call. Chris Smith, what do you think about Bill de Blasio as a potential, I don't know, catalyst for change nationally or flag bearer nationally for a new kind of progressive politics? Does this guy translate? And is he likely to, you know, be fuel for that Occupy Omaha?
Yeah. Well, certainly the issues de Blasio emphasized in the campaign are big, big problems in urban areas all over America. Large and small cities are facing these kinds of gaps. And yeah, I mean, de Blasio isn't at this point trying to lead a crusade. He's much more concerned with doing things like negotiating contracts with 100-plus unions here in the city. But even there, if he can bring his ideals to the table, you know, he's come out of the union movement in a lot of ways. You know, can he give those folks a better chance at being remaining part of the middle class? Just like Ellis says, a lot of the manufacturing jobs here in the city have disappeared. In many ways, some of them have been replaced by government jobs. And Blasio, you know, has to find a way to pay those people better at the same time that he's not bankrupting the city. And that's an issue, you know, union pensions, union pay rates that resonates everywhere across this country.
And page one news today of the challenges he's going to be facing with new contract talks in New York and an anticipated $2 billion deficit in New York next year. Tina in East Providence, Rhode Island. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I grew up in New York City, and I grew up in downtown New York during the 70s and 80s. And I went back a couple of weeks ago with one of my children. And I've been back, you know, several times since I moved to Rhode Island. But I was shocked and sort of depressed upon going into the meatpacking district, which is close to where I grew up, because it was like walking into some kind of, like, vision of a luxury bubble, and the people walking the streets, the whole scene was completely unrecognizable to me, and it could have been any major city in the world, like some high-end area.
This is
and
a part of Manhattan that's become very hot, very hip, the meatpacking
yes,
district.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you know, it was getting that way when I left, but the scale of things was so extreme and so kind of out of touch with the average person's kind of version of reality that I really felt like I was on another planet. But that being said, I think Giuliani and Bloomberg, you know, during the 70s and 80s, New York was, it was a dysfunctional, dangerous, dirty city. And so on many levels, what they did was very important because they kind of shaped it up and organized it and laid the groundwork so that it could become like a global player again.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really important to shift again because it needs some of its humanity back. It's kind of this glossy tourist dreamland.
Yeah.
And you could literally walk around these areas and just never have a sense of any of the history or the texture of what the actual city should be and at heart is. And I think de Blasio can really bring, not just in the equality issues, but you know, New York should be all about that. Bring some of that back into this picture of this, like, weird globalized,
sort
you know,
glittering wealth dome, that which is awfully fun to visit. But I know just what you mean, Tina, and I'm really glad you call and put it that way. Mitra, how about it? Ella says, without the manufacturing that used to be around, it's going to be hard to really close this gap. What about the prospect for closing it, for really making a change? Everybody knows what Tina's talking about. If you visited New York in the last decade, I mean, it's great, but this is Richtown, USA in many parts. And
that's absolutely right. And even in the neighborhood, so, for example, Times Square seediness, I live in Jackson Heights in Queens.
Yeah.
A lot of the prostitution and kind of the nudie bars, if you will, mm-hmm. there's a whole strip on Roosevelt Avenue where I live, and it's all come over there. And even that area now is considering getting chain retail. And I think it's just a matter of a few years that it might resemble what the caller described in the meatpacking district. So this shift is something New Yorkers are watching very closely because at many community meetings over development, the question is what's in it for us, and the number of jobs that are promised never quite materialize or are not the kinds of jobs that, as Ellis pointed out, you need to sustain an economy. In this sense, I think Bloomberg did leave a few, and his legacy might be some of the incubators that he's established. The tech industry certainly is growing. I covered Silicon Alley in the late 90s, early 2000s, and the tech innovation that you see now is so much greater than 10, 15 years ago. Biotech is forever said to be the answer to every city's woes, and sure enough, that's happened again this time around. But, you know, he's established some R&D, some research and development facilities on Roosevelt Island. And so there is a lot that you can point to that's going in the right direction. But as we've all said, this is not going to happen overnight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New York City's new mayor-elect Bill de Blasio, now the country's most prominent progressive politician, with a landslide win and a mandate to fight inequality in the city of Wall Street and big money finance. Ellis Hennigan is with us, columnist at New York Newsday, AM New York, Fox News, political analyst Chris Smith is here, contributing editor at New York Magazine. He's written so much, talked so deeply with Bill de Blasio and Mayor Bloomberg. Mitra Kalita is with us, ideas editor at Quartz, the Atlantic Magazine's online business publication. She joins us from New York today. Well, we've got all kinds of interesting response here online, and a lot of it. Judy in New York says, I'm hoping his equivalent will appear in Chicago. We need a mayor who puts the public interest ahead of corporate privatization. Al-Sordi says the Wall Street cabal should be relieved, given what they've been getting away with. If not de Blasio to stem their excesses, it would eventually be a dude named Guevara. That's in shade. Daniel says, good luck with your decision, New York. You elected an unabashed and unashamed socialist with communist sympathies. Have fun. And Mark says, back to the bad old 70s, crime will skyrocket over the next 2 years. You watch. Ellis, what about on the crime front? The stop and frisk has been a big deal. Bloomberg's administration has stood up for it, even now as a judge says, don't do that. What's de Blasio promised on stop and frisk?
To stop and frisk. But you know what? If Mike Bloomberg was going to be around for a fourth term, and that's hard to get your head around,
yeah.
But if it were true, he'd probably stop it as well. I mean, it is a technique that has lost its legitimacy. We can argue about how effective it is, and I think there's evidence it points in both directions on that. But it has reached the point that it has alienated enough people on the street, innocent people who've – too many of them have been stopped at this point. And it's hard to imagine that it can continue into the years to come, and it won't. He's going to stop it as soon as he gets here.
Chris, give us Bill de Blasio's nutshell biography. A lot of people beyond New York may not know it well. He's got a very, very interesting background.
He does. In some instances, I think he's trying to compensate for Bloomberg's boringness on a lot of levels by being almost too interesting. Bill de Blasio is 52 years old, 6'5" tall, tallest mayor in New York City history.
All right.
Grew up – born in New York City, but grew up primarily in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His parents are a fascinating story. His father went to Yale, was horrifically injured in World War II, lost part of one of his legs, came back to the United States, went to graduate school at Harvard, eventually worked in D.C., I believe it was the Office of War Information at that time. His wife, de Blasio's mother, also in public service for the federal government. And in the 50s, they got accused of being communist sympathizers, caught up in the McCarthy era, and essentially exonerated. Nothing to it, but it was scarring in a lot of ways, personally and career-wise. Both of them ended up leaving. The family left D.C., moved to Massachusetts eventually. And the marriage deteriorated. De Blasio's father became a heavy drinker and had lung cancer and eventually committed suicide after de Blasio's parents had divorced.
And Bill de Blasio, of course, was not raised as Bill de Blasio, but as Warner Wilhelm, later changed
right.
his name, took his mother's maiden name, took, I guess, his childhood nickname of Billy or Bill. Flash forward with us, if you would, to the Sandinista years of Bill.
Yeah, not so much years. He made one trip to Nicaragua in his mid-20s. He was certainly then and now enthusiastic in the idea, you know, espousing the ideals of the egalitarian society
yeah.
the Sandinistas said they wanted to create.
Even back in New York, insane. After his visit there, he was a big supporter.
Sure, but he was also even in those days something of a hardball political operative. I mean, he let a sit-in at NYU when he was in college there in favor of longer library hours.
Okay.
I mean, that's not exactly a radical demand. You know, he wasn't trying to
presaging
nationalize
pre-K
the university.
Education. Okay,
exactly. Yeah, and then you know, he went to graduate school at Columbia. Was a low-level aide in the David Dinkins mayorality here and then worked behind the scenes as a campaign strategist for the Bill Clinton presidential campaign, the Hillary Clinton senatorial campaign, was the New York, New Jersey regional director of HUD under Andrew Cuomo when he was HUD secretary, and eventually decided that he wanted to run for office himself and ran for city council first and then a job called public advocate here in the city. And, you know, you talk to his friends and family and they're not surprised. They thought he would run for public office all along, that he would make the jump from operative to elected official. But he retains a great deal of that strategist perspective, mm-hmm. and it's probably one of his greatest political strengths.
Ellis Hennekin, a big deal for him in this campaign was his now long ago marriage to a fellow Dinkins administration worker, which gave him this image of the kind of new American family, mixed race, and right out there in the streets with his wife and children right up front in the campaign.
That is right. And it turned out to be just a perfect way to present himself to a city that is as diverse as this one. The kids were in the commercials. They were everywhere in the campaign. And listen, that's the way people live now.
Yeah.
And he did a great job of presenting that.
His son Dante out there with his big afro turned out to be a big selling point for his dad in this campaign. A father who's promising a progressive agenda in a city that's had Rudy Giuliani and then Michael Bloomberg. Alex is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I moved to New York like so many people do, chasing this sort of reputation that New York has as being an artistic community, someplace where you don't have to be rich to go and sort of make it as an artist and really experience the city. And I was super disappointed to find that that's just not the case anymore. And me and all of my friends that I had there, we had to leave. I had to move to Nashville 2 months ago because it's not sustainable. I paid so much money to live 40 minutes away from the city. And it never felt like New York wanted me there.
Because what? It took too much money to live there. You couldn't be the struggling bohemian.
Right, exactly. And that's supposed to be part of the big reputation of New York, is a place for struggling bohemians. And that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's sad. And I have friends who lived there for 20 years doing the struggling bohemian thing. Now they have a kid and they've left too.
Out they go. Alex, you bring that home to us. Mitra Kalita, if New York can't attract and nurture people like Alex, I mean, that has historically been a big part of its appeal. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. But if there's no first rung even to make the try, is that trouble for the city, Mitra?
It's great trouble. In fact, ironically, we just had an artist who called in. I was at the Queens Museum over the weekend, which mm-hmm. was the site of the World's Fair. I'm drawing a blank on the year, 1930s, I think. And there was a model of New York City, and what was most prominent on the model is that all of the public housing was bright red, because at the time, New York City was so proud of having affordable housing for residents, and it was something to, you know, boast about. Today, affordable housing is hardly something that, you know, except for Bill de Blasio, who sort of mentioned it over and over again and talked about community hospitals over luxury condos and the need to offer these services. It's certainly not that same view of providing for people that the city used to do. There are a number of artists who are leaving the city. If not Nashville, they're going to Philadelphia or other more affordable places, even the suburbs of the city. And the loss of this creative class, which is, you know, something that has defined New York for more than a century, is indeed a big loss, not just for the fabric of New York, but also economically. And so what you're starting to see are, you know, you have various affordable artist programs and studios, and neighborhoods are trying to hang on to them. But if you can't have them paying the rent, I mean, it's just absolutely an unsustainable model.
All kinds of fortunes made, but I guess you could choke on that, too, if too many get shut out. Ibrahim in Charlottesville, Virginia. What do you think, Ibrahim? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens. And, my parents came out of the – I was born in the 70s. So I think there's an interesting arc here from sort of the racial politics of the Lindsay era all the way through to the real – tumultuous eras of the Dinkins and Giuliani administration to having a to having a biracial couple, a multiracial couple. My wife is Indian. We have black. I'm African American. We have biracial children. We left New York, and one of the reasons we came back, and we just moved back to Brooklyn, is that that it's a place where they can walk around and see people that look like them because they're multiracial, and it won't be weird. And I think that that's going to be one of the lasting legacies of the de Blasio era.
I probably no question about it. The first family is going to look like a lot of New York families. But I wonder, Ellis, if that also pushes then Bill de Blasio on his solve inequality theme. I mean, you go out into big parts of Queens and you've got huge areas there that are not part of the, you know, diamond-crusted life, yet they look more like his family. Does that give him an extra incentive, responsibility to keep the opportunity open?
It does, and it very well may be a harbinger of what America's going to look like, right? I mean, one of the reasons that national politics is changing is that the demographics of the country are changing, and we're just a little ahead of that curve. And so we're dealing with it now, and, you know, in Texas and Florida and Illinois and California, a lot of other places are likely to be dealing with it soon enough. So watch us. See how we do. See if we can pull it off.
Everybody's watching already. Mike in Albany. Albany, where there's going to be an interesting story now about funding all this, or some of it anyway. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, a lot of us cheering on de Blasio's fight against inequality are wondering how it's going to fare when it gets up here to Albany, where, you know, kind of big money and Wall Street still rule the roost, and the legislature and the governor control the destiny of the city to a large extent. If he wants to tax millionaires to pay for pre-K, he's got to get it through Albany. If he wants local control of the minimum wage to get better pay for low-wage workers, he's got to get it through Albany. If he wants more housing subsidies, a lot of that will come through Albany. So I was wondering if the panel could talk about that.
We'll look right at it. Chris Smith, how about it? New York mayor has a lot of visibility. But Andrew Cuomo and the state capitol in Albany, you know, can sort of put their foot on the pipeline here. What about his prospects there with the state legislature and with his old boss, Andrew Cuomo? Is Governor Cuomo supportive?
It's a very complicated dynamic. I mean, de Blasio has going for him the fact that he won with an enormous landslide and campaigned on very specific issues. So he can go to Albany and say, look, this is what the people overwhelmingly elected me to do. This is what New York City voters want. Many of you legislators who represent New York City districts, you know, this is what you should be behind. He and Cuomo have a genuine personal friendship going back 20 years plus. They're also, and this is probably their greatest bond, deeply pragmatic politicians. De Blasio believes a lot of what he's saying philosophically, but one of the more fascinating things in reporting about him is talking to de Blasio's allies, you know, people who are some of his greatest supporters on the left, who don't entirely trust him to follow through. You know, I had one guy say to me, you know, we want him to be Elizabeth Warren, not Andrew Cuomo, which I thought was really
by which
revealing.
He means what? Bone-deep progressive.
Correct. You know, someone who's going to fight the good fight and not compromise. Cuomo on the left in New York is seen as a guy who's, you know, deeply ambitious and puts his own agenda ahead of, you know, what he's campaigned on and talked about. And they wonder if de Blasio is going to turn out to be the same thing. I'm not sure. I mean, they both have a lot of self-interest in expanding pre-K. My belief is that ultimately it won't be through a tax increase that Cuomo will find a way to fund it. It just won't be through that boost on the wealthy. And whether de Blasio feels the need to push for that symbolically is going to be an interesting crossroads in the next couple of months.
Mitra, I mean, we've been reading about pre-K dreams and plans in action all over the place. Oklahoma, for heaven's sakes, the big push on the pre-K front. How effective does that look to you as though it can be in addressing the inequality issue in New York City? Does the city have the patience to invest in pre-K, you know, for now, for a payoff in a generation from now? Will just the action, the act of doing it, if they get that set up, be a sign of good faith that will be encouraging for people, that help is on the way if they're on the lower part of the two cities tail?
So the research shows that the number of words that a toddler is exposed to actually has correlation to their future earning potential. So definitely economic research shows that we want to get kids early into an educational environment and set them up for later in life. So de Blasio is definitely appealing to the long run here. You know, you kind of look at this and feel not so great about, you know, for the Bloomberg years, that's 12 years, you have students who've gone through school and are in high school about to enter college, and nobody really is talking much about the middle school. He's talking a little bit about after school, but I think a lot of the early childhood experts are saying you need to get them early to really make a difference.
But it's a long time till those kids grow up and get into the middle
of their
career.
And it's also it's not necessarily going to be felt by the time he has to run for re-election. That's right.
Ellis Hennekin, what do you imagine the country is going to make of this experiment now in New York over the next couple of years? We're headed into 2016, the presidential campaign. Is this going to factor into the national conversation about, you know, where the country wants to put the dial now on inequality, equality, progressive, conservative politics? Is this going to have an impact?
It will. As always, New York will be a laboratory for that sort of stuff. And how it is that we imagine our own future is crucially important. New York has never been cheap. It's not going to be cheap. We will always have a lot of poor people here, and some of them may be in pre-K classes, and I guess that's a good thing. But let's see some results. Let's see how well we do. And boy, let us pray that crime does not go up, because people will be jittery about that.
Everybody, I think, will join you in that. Take an E with Ellis Hennekin right there. Ellis, it's always great to have you, columnist for New York Newsday, AM New York, Fox News political analyst. Thank you for joining us today on Bill de Blasio, Ellis.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
Mitra Kalita with Quartz, ideas editor there. Wonderful to have you with us from New York, Mitra.
Thank you, Tom.
And Chris Smith at New York Magazine. You're the best, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, love your thoughts on Bill de Blasio, his agenda, New York, equality in the Big Apple and beyond. Let us hear from you at onpointradio.org, at onpointradio on Twitter and Facebook, at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.